Divine Principle Part I Chapter 6 Predestination. It is true that theological controversies about predestination have caused great confusion in the religious lives of many Christians. We must understand what brought this about. In the Bible, there are many passages that could be interpreted to mean that the fortune or misfortune, happiness or misery of any individual, as well as the salvation or damnation of fallen men and the rise and fall of nations, all occur according to God's predestination. For example, the Bible says, "Those whom he predestined he also called. And those whom he called he also justified. And those whom he justified he also glorified." Rom 8-30, again it says, "I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion." So it depends not upon man's will or exertion, but upon God's mercy. Rom 9:15-16, it again says Rom 9:21, "Has the potter no right over the clay, to make out of the same lump one vessel for beauty and another for menial use?" It also says Rom 9:11-13, that God loved Jacob and hated Esau while they were still in their mother's womb, and said the elder would serve the younger. In this way, there are ample biblical grounds to justify complete predestination. But we must not forget that there are also many biblical passages that deny complete predestination. For example, when we see that God warned the first human ancestors not to eat of the fruit Gen 2:17, in order to prevent them from falling, it is evident that man's fall was not God's predestination but the result of man's disobedience to God's commandment. Again, we read Gen 6:6, that God was sorry that he had put man on earth. If man had fallen according to God's predestination, there would be no reason for him to be sorry for his having created man, whose fall he would have predestined. John 3:16 says that whoever believes in Christ shall not perish. When we read in Matthew 7:7, "Ask, and it will be given you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you." We can see well enough that all things are not accomplished merely by the predestination of God, but by human endeavor. If all things are to be accomplished solely by God's predestination, why did God so emphasize human efforts? Again, when we read that we should pray for sick brothers James 5:14, we can understand that suffering due to sickness is not by the predestination of God. If all things were inevitably decided by God's predestination, there would be no need for man's tearful prayers. If we accept the traditional belief of predestination, man's prayers, evangelism, charity and other human endeavors would be of no use whatsoever to God's providence of restoration. And any such endeavor would ultimately be useless. This is because the predestination of God, who is absolute, should also be absolute, without leaving room for any change due to human effort. Since there are sufficient biblical grounds to justify either acceptance or rejection of the theory of predestination, controversies over the doctrine of predestination are inevitable. How, then, would the principle solve such problems? Let us investigate the question of predestination. Section I, Predestination of the Will. Let us first define will before discussing predestination of the will. God could not accomplish his purpose of creation due to the human fall. Therefore, the will of God, in working his providence with fallen man, is to accomplish his purpose of creation. In other words, the will means the fulfillment of the purpose of the providence of restoration. Next, we must know that God first determines the will, and then works to accomplish it. Having created man, God set up his will to accomplish the purpose of creation. However, due to the human fall, he was unable to accomplish the will. Naturally, in order to accomplish it, he has to determine his will a second time, and thus he carries out the providence of restoration. God predestines the will to be one of goodness, not of evil. Then he works to accomplish it. Since God is the essence of goodness, his purpose of creation must also be one of goodness. Naturally, the purpose of his providence of restoration must be good, and his will to accomplish this purpose must also be good. God could not have predestined that which obstructs and is against the purpose of creation. Thus, we know that he could not have predetermined such things as the human fall, judgment of fallen men, or the destruction of the universe. If such evil results had been the necessary product of God's predestination, he would not have regretted the evil result of his own predestination, and we could not think of God as the subject of goodness. God, looking at fallen men, was sorry that he had made man on earth Gen 6:6. And, seeing King Saul's faithlessness, he repented that he had made Saul king. 2 Samuel 15:11. This is good evidence that these events were not the result of God's predestination. Such evil results occur from man's failure to accomplish his portion of responsibility, and from his being on the side of Satan. To what extent does God predetermine the will to accomplish his purpose of creation? God is the absolute being, unique, eternal, and unchangeable. So God's purpose of creation must be the same. Accordingly, the will of the providence of restoration, which is to accomplish the purpose of creation, should be unique, unchangeable, and absolute. Isaiah 46:11. God predetermines the will to be absolute. So, when a person chosen for the will fails to accomplish it, God must go on to fulfill it, even by setting up another person in place of the one who failed. For example, when God's will to fulfill the purpose of creation centering on Adam failed, he sent Jesus as the second Adam, attempting to fulfill the will centering on him, because his predestination of the will was absolute. When this will was again a failure, due to the disbelief of the people, cf. Part I, ch. 4, sec. I, 2, 141, Jesus promised the Lord would come and fulfill the will without fail. Matt 16:27. Again, in Adam's family, God intended to lay the foundation to receive the Messiah through his providence centered on Cain and Abel. However, this will ended in failure when Cain killed Abel. Then, God intended to accomplish his will through Noah's family. When Noah's family failed to accomplish this will, God had to set up Abraham to fulfill the will. In another instance, God intended to fulfill the will which Abel failed to accomplish by setting up Seth. Genesis 4:25. Also, he attempted to fulfill the will unaccomplished by Moses by choosing Joshua in his stead. Joshua 1:5. And again, he tried to fulfill the will unaccomplished due to the betrayal of Judas Iscariot by electing Matthias. Acts 1:15. Section 2, Predestination for the Fulfillment of the Will. As clarified in the principle of creation, God's purpose of creation is to be fulfilled only by man's accomplishment of his portion of responsibility. The will for the providence of restoration, which is to fulfill this purpose, being absolute, is not for man to interfere with. However, man must accomplish his own portion of responsibility in order for the will to be accomplished. Therefore, God's purpose of creation was to be fulfilled only through man's accomplishing his portion of responsibility by not eating of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Genesis 2:17. Accordingly, even in accomplishing the purpose of the providence of restoration, the will can be fulfilled only through the accomplishment of man's responsibility by the central figure in charge of the mission. In Jesus' day, the people should have believed in Jesus absolutely, in order that he might accomplish the purpose of the providence of salvation. But due to their disbelief, they could not accomplish their portion of responsibility, and naturally, the accomplishment of the will had to be postponed to the day of the second advent. Then, to what degree and to what extent would God predetermine the accomplishment of the will? As mentioned, God's will to accomplish the purpose of the providence of restoration is absolute, but the accomplishment of the will is relative. So, it is predetermined that the will is to be accomplished, but only through God's 95% responsibility and man's 5% responsibility combined. Indicating the proportion of man's responsibility as 5% is only to say that man's responsibility is extremely small compared to God's. Nevertheless, we must understand that, for man, it means 100% effort. To cite examples, the accomplishment of the will centering on Adam and Eve was predestined to be fulfilled by the fulfillment of their own portion of responsibility, namely, by not eating of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The providence of restoration centering on Noah was predestined to be fulfilled by the accomplishment of his own portion of responsibility, through his loyalty in building the ark. The providence of salvation through Jesus was predestined to be accomplished through the fulfillment of responsibility on the part of fallen men by their believing in Jesus as the Messiah and following him. John 3:16. Men have caused the prolongation of God's providence of restoration by not fulfilling even their small amount of responsibility. The Bible says, "The prayer of faith will save the sick man." James 5:15. "Your faith has made you well." Mark 5:34. "For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be opened." Matt 7:8. All these biblical passages prove that the will is predestined to be fulfilled by the accomplishment of man's own portion of responsibility. We can understand well enough how small were the responsibilities men took charge of in all these instances, compared to God's responsible portion of toil and grace. At the same time, from the fact that through their failure to accomplish their portions of responsibility, the central figures in the providence were compelled to cause the prolongation of the providence of restoration, we can well imagine how extremely difficult it was for them to fulfill even a relatively small responsibility. Section 3, Predestination of Man. Adam and Eve could have become good human ancestors if they had accomplished their own portion of responsibility by obeying God's injunction not to eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but they failed to do so. Therefore, God could not predestine them, absolutely, to be good human ancestors. In the case of fallen men, a chosen man could become a person of God's predestination only by accomplishing his own portion of responsibility. Therefore, God cannot predestine a certain person with absolute certainty that he will become what he is predestined to be. Then, to what degree does God predestine man? In God's accomplishment of his will, centering on the certain person, he establishes it as an indispensable condition that the man must fulfill his own portion of responsibility. Therefore, God, in predestining a person for a certain mission, determines that the person will be what he is predestined to be only by the 100% accomplishment of the will centering on the person, with God's portion of 95% responsibility and man's portion of 5% responsibility accomplished together. Therefore, if the person fails to accomplish his own portion of responsibility, he cannot become the person God predestined. For example, when God chose Moses, he predestined him to be the great leader capable of bringing the elected people to the blessed land of Canaan, but only by accomplishing his own portion of responsibility. Exodus 3:10. When in Kadesh Barnea Moses went against God's will by striking the rock twice, he failed to carry out his responsibility, thus nullifying God's predestination. He died on the way to the appointed place. Numbers 20:7-12, 20-24, 27-14. Likewise, when God chose Judas Iscariot, he predestined him to be Jesus' apostle if he accomplished his own portion of responsibility with loyalty. However, since Judas failed to carry out his responsibility, God's predestination was not fulfilled and Judas turned out to be a betrayer. When God called the Jewish people, he predestined them to be the chosen nation of glory, but only by fulfilling their portion of responsibility through their faith and service. Nevertheless, the predestination was not realized because they delivered Jesus to be crucified. And therefore, the chosen nation was scattered. Next, let us examine the conditions and qualifications for becoming the central figure of the providence of restoration in God's predestination. The purpose of God's providence of salvation is to restore the fallen world to the original world of creation. Though the times of their salvation may differ, all fallen men are predestined to be saved. 1 Peter 3:9. Just as with the process of his creation, God's providence of salvation, which is the providence of recreation, cannot be accomplished in a moment. Therefore, this providence is gradually broadening its scope to cover the whole, starting from one. Thus, in the predestination of the providence of salvation, God first predestines the central figure and calls him to the mission. What conditions and qualifications must this central figure have? First, he must be born out of the chosen nation, in charge of the providence of restoration. Next, even within the chosen nation, he must be the descendant of ancestors with many accomplishments of goodness. Then, even though he may be the descendant of ancestors with many good deeds, he must be endowed with a natural disposition suitable for the accomplishment of the will. Even if a man has these endowments, he must subsequently have good conditions in which to grow and work in his lifetime. Still, even among these persons, God would select first the individual most fully prepared at the appropriate time and place of God's need. Section 4, Elucidation of Biblical Verses which Justify the Theory of Predestination. We have clarified many problems concerning God's predestination. But the problem yet to be solved is how to elucidate the biblical records, such as those enumerated in the introduction to this chapter, which are written as though all things are of God's absolute predestination. Let us first elucidate Romans 8:29-30, which says, "For those whom he foreknew he also predestined. And those whom he predestined he also called. And those whom he called he also justified. And those whom he justified he also glorified." God, being omniscient, knows who is endowed with the qualities to be the central figure in the providence of restoration CF Sec. III, 199. Therefore, God predestines and calls the person he foreknew in order to fulfill the purpose of the providence of restoration. Calling the person is God's portion of responsibility, but this alone has nothing to do with the person's being justified and finally glorified in God. He must accomplish his own responsibility in the position of a person called by God before he can be justified. Only after he is thus justified will he be glorified by God. It is predestined that man can enjoy glory from God only by accomplishing his own portion of responsibility. There are no words such as man's own portion of responsibility in the Bible, so everything appears to be accomplished merely by God's absolute predestination. The Bible says Rom 9:15-16. I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. So it depends not upon man's will or exertion, but upon God's mercy. As elucidated above, God chooses the one who is most suitable for the fulfillment of the purpose of restoration, foreknowing all his qualities. Therefore, it is God's privilege to elect such a person and to have mercy on him or have compassion for him. It depends not upon man's desire or endeavor. These biblical verses are given in order to emphasize the power and grace of God. It is again said Rom 9:21, has the potter no right over the clay, to make out of the same lump one vessel for beauty and another for menial use? It has already been said that God set up man's own portion of responsibility as the condition to exalt him to be the Lord of all creation and to love him most by having man take after his creative nature. However, man fell, having violated this condition. Therefore, man became an existence deserted like trash. So this verse was given to teach people that man has no right to complain against whatever way God may handle men of this kind. Further, the Bible states that God loved Jacob but hated Esau, and that the elder will serve the younger. Rom 9:10-13. What must have been the reason that God loved Jacob and hated Esau while they were not yet born and had done nothing, either good or bad? This was to fulfill God's program in the course of the providence of restoration. Further details will be discussed in the section covering the providence of restoration centering on Abraham's family CF Part 2, CH 1, Sec. III, 261. We must understand here that God gave Isaac twin sons, Esau and Jacob, because he had to restore through indemnity the will for the restoration of the birthright, which had been left unaccomplished by Cain's killing of Abel and Adam's family. This he intended to do by setting up the twin brothers in the positions of Cain and Abel, and by having Jacob in the position of Abel make Esau in the position of Cain give in. God said this because Esau, being in the position of Cain, was liable to be hated by God, while Jacob, being in the position of Abel, was entitled to his love. God's actually either loving or hating one or the other depended upon the fulfillment of their respective portions of responsibility. In fact, Esau, having surrendered in obedience to Jacob, received a blessing of love equal to Jacob's though he was in the position liable to be hated by God. On the other hand, Jacob, though he was in the position to be loved by God, could not have received such love if he had failed to accomplish his portion of responsibility. It was because of ignorance about the relationship of man's portion of responsibility to God's in fulfilling the purpose of the providence of restoration that there appeared a man like Calvin, who obstinately held to his theory of predestination, and that such a theory has been believed by so many people for so long as one remains ignorant of the principle. It is truly regrettable that many religious men, having failed to overcome this test, have nullified in an instant the merit they gained through their long and bitter trials in the ascetic life. How then can we prevent such confusion among men of spiritual communication? God has given a partial mission to numerous individuals in order to accomplish rapidly the purpose of the providence of restoration, with each relating vertically to him during the process of the providence. Therefore, horizontal conflict among men of spiritual communication is inevitable. Finally, at the consummation of human history, all will come to realize that their respective missions were allotted to them by God with an identical purpose, the accomplishment of the providence of restoration. By establishing horizontal relationships with each other, they will be unified in their efforts to accomplish the whole purpose of the providence of restoration through the new words of truth God will give at the proper time. Then, All men of spiritual communication will cease their stubborn insistence that their way alone is God's will, and will gain the right understanding of their providential missions. Thus, they will not only be able to overcome all confusion, but each will also be able to perfect his own mission in the course of his life in faith. 7. The First Resurrection. The First Resurrection is the resurrection enabling the accomplishment of the purpose of creation for the first time since the commencement of the history of God's providence of restoration. The original self will be restored by removing man's original sin through the second advent of the Lord. Therefore, the hope of all Christians is to share in the first resurrection. What kind of people may share in this? Those who are the first to believe in the Lord at the second advent, following and serving Him, will be those who participate. By doing this, they cooperate with Him in setting up the condition of indemnity, on a general and worldwide basis, for the course of the providence of restoration. Thus, they fulfill the purpose of creation, having become spirit men of the divine spirit stage, by removing the original sin before all other men. These are the people who can share in the first resurrection. Next, let us study what 144,000 as indicated in the Bible, means. In order for the Lord to accomplish the providence of restoration at His second advent, He must lay the foundation for victory over the satanic world. He must set up horizontally, in His lifetime, the people who can restore through indemnity the positions of the saints and sages of history who have been invaded by Satan or have failed to accomplish their portions of responsibility. The total number of saints whom the Lord of the Second Advent must find and set up for this purpose is 144,000, as written in Revelation 7-4 and 14:1-4. In the course of God's providence of restoration, Jacob, who had the mission of restoring the family, started his mission centering on his 12 sons. And Moses started his mission of restoring a nation with 12 tribes under him. When each tribe multiplies after the pattern of the 12 sons, the total will be 144. Jesus, who had the mission of restoring the world, had 12 disciples in order to restore through indemnity the number 144, both spiritually and physically. But, due to his crucifixion, he has been able to work only spiritually for restoration through indemnity. Therefore, just as Jacob had 12 sons in order to restore horizontally, through indemnity, the 12 vertical generations from Noah to Abraham which had been claimed by Satan, the Lord of the Second Advent must set up a certain necessary number of saints corresponding to the number 144, in order to restore this number horizontally, through indemnity, both spiritually and physically. 3. The Providence of Resurrection for Spirit Men. 1. The reason and method of the spirit man's resurrection through second coming. According to the principle of creation, man's spirit was created to grow only through give and take action between the life element from God and the vitality element from man's physical body. Therefore, the spirit man can neither grow nor be resurrected apart from our physical body. So in order that spirit men, who passed away to the other world without having perfected themselves in their physical life on earth, might be resurrected, they must come again to earth and fulfill the responsibility they left unaccomplished in their physical life on earth, through the physical bodies of earthly men, by cooperating with the earthly saints and helping them fulfill the same mission. This is why Jude 1-14 says that in last days the Lord will come with His holy myriads. In what manner do spirit men cooperate with earthly men to accomplish the will? When earthly saints form a reciprocal base with spirit men, through prayer and other spiritual activities, the spirit men descend and form reciprocal bases with the spirits of the earthly men, on which bases they cooperate. Thus, the spirit men pour out spiritual fire on earthly men, give them the power to heal diseases, and help them do many mighty works. More than that, they enable earthly men to see many facts in the spirit world in a state of trance, give them the gift of prophecy, and inspire them spiritually. Through such activities, substituting for the Holy Spirit, they cooperate with earthly men to fulfill the will of God. 2. Resurrection through second coming of spirit men who are Christians in their lifetime. I resurrection through second coming in the growth stage. Those form spirits of the Old Testament age who in their lifetime had earnestly served God by observing the law on earth all descended after the advent of the Messiah and cooperated with the earthly saints to fulfill the will, and thus enter the life spirit stage. Spirit men who have thus come again and cooperate with earthly men can obtain the same benefit as those men. Having become life spirits, they enter paradise. We call this resurrection through second coming in the growth stage. Let us take some examples from the Bible. From the record that Elijah appeared, as a spirit, before Jesus and his disciples Matt 17:3, it is clear that Elijah is still in the spirit world. Meanwhile, Jesus called John the Baptist Elijah. Jesus said this because Elijah descended to John the Baptist and cooperated with him to achieve the mission he left unaccomplished on earth, thus attaining the purpose of resurrection through second coming. So the physical body of John the Baptist substituted for that of Elijah, when seen from the standpoint of their mission. On the other hand, Matthew 27:52 states that, upon the crucifixion of Jesus, the tombs were opened and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. This does not mean that their physical bodies, which had already decomposed in the earth, were raised. This is merely a record of the fact that the spirit men of the Old Testament age, who had stayed in the spirit world as form spirits, descended in order to enter the life spirit stage by cooperating with the saints on earth, who were in a position to benefit by the ransom of the cross. If the saints of the Old Testament age had literally been raised from the tombs, they would surely have given witness to Jesus as the Messiah. Then, would not the people have believed that Jesus, who was testified to by the saints raised from the tombs, was the Messiah? Their activities would have been recorded in the Bible. But we have no such record in the Bible, other than the fact that they were raised from the tombs. From this, we may understand that these were spirit men who could be seen for a brief interval, only by those whose spiritual eyes were opened. Compared to paradise, which people could enter through the ransom by the cross of Jesus, the region where the spirit men of the Old Testament age were staying was darker and full of misery. Thus, it was called a tomb. Resurrection through second coming in the perfection stage. Those life spirits of the New Testament age who believed in Jesus on earth and thus went to paradise are to come again to earth after the second advent of the Messiah. These spirits, by cooperating with the earthly saints and believing in and serving the Lord of the second advent, thereby elevating them to the divine spirit stage, would themselves become divine spirits. Thus, they can enter the kingdom of heaven in the spirit world with the earthly saints, who would enter this kingdom after leaving their physical bodies. This providence of resurrection is called the providence of resurrection through second coming in the perfection stage. Since from the standpoint of this providence, earthly men consequently come to cooperate with spirit men, not to speak of the spirit men's cooperating with earthly men. Hebrews 11:39-40 says, "All these saints of the Old Testament age, though well attested by their faith, did not receive what was promised permission to enter the kingdom of heaven, since God had foreseen something better, the kingdom of heaven for us earthly men, that apart from us earthly men they spirit men should not be made perfect citizens in the kingdom of heaven." This biblical passage demonstrates the principle that, apart from the cooperation of earthly men, the spirit men of the spirit world cannot perfect themselves. Also, in Matthew 18:18, it is said, "Whatever you earthly saints bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Clarifying that whatever is bound by spirit men shall not be loosed unless the earthly saints loose it. Thus spirit men can be resurrected only by descending to the earthly saints and cooperating with them. Therefore, as we read in Matthew 16:9, Jesus gave the keys of the kingdom of heaven to Peter, who represented the earthly saints, so that he might open the gate of heaven here on earth. 3. Resurrection through second coming of spirit men outside of paradise. First, let us examine the manner in which spirit men who believed in religions other than Christianity in their lives can be resurrected through their second coming. In the same manner that all men, in order to accomplish a common purpose, must first establish a reciprocal base, earthly men and spirit men must also establish a reciprocal base between them in order to fulfill the common purpose of the providence of restoration. Therefore, the spirit men who come again for resurrection first choose earthly men of the same religion they believed in during their earthly life as their suitable objects to work through, and then descend to the specific men of their choice. Thus, they come to enjoy the same benefits as the earthly men, by assisting them to accomplish the purpose of restoration. Second, let us investigate in what manner the good spirit men, who in their earthly life lived conscientiously though they did not have any religion, can be resurrected through second coming. There can be no absolutely good man among fallen men, since he would have the original sin inherent in him. Therefore, by good spirit men, we mean those in possession of more goodness than evil within themselves. This type of good spirit man descends to good earthly men, and by cooperating with them to fulfill the purpose of God's restoration, finally enjoys the same benefits with them. Third, let us study in what manner evil spirit men can be resurrected through their second coming. In Matthew 25-41, we read about the cursed, who are liable to the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. The angels of the devil means the evil spirit men working under the control of the devil. The spiritual creatures commonly called ghosts, whose real nature has not been known, are none other than such evil spirit men. These evil spirits also gain the benefit of the age by descending on earthly men. However, not all the works of evil spirit men result in their receiving the benefit of resurrection through second coming. Their works must first all result in establishing a condition of indemnity for God's intention to eradicate the sins of earthly men by punishment, before the evil spirit men can obtain the benefit of resurrection through second coming. Then, how do the works of evil spirits result in exercising judgment on behalf of God? Let us consider another example. Suppose there is an earthly man who is entitled to go from the sphere of benefit of the family level to that of the tribal level, through the benefit of the age and the providence of restoration. However, if this man has a certain debt of sin, either his own or his ancestors, he cannot go to the sphere of benefit of the tribal level without having liquidated the sin by setting up a corresponding condition of indemnity. In this case, God can allow the evil spirit to torment the earthly man as punishment for his sin. Then, if this man gladly endures the torment given by the evil spirit man, he can graduate from the sphere of benefit of the family level to that of the tribal level, with his endurance as the condition of indemnity. In this case, the evil spirit man receives a share of the benefit. In this way, the providence of restoration broadens its scope in accordance with the benefit of the age, from the sphere of benefit of the family level, to that of the tribal level, national level, and finally to that of the worldwide level. Whenever he is to graduate to the next level of the sphere of benefit of the age, the person in charge of the providence must necessarily set up a condition of indemnity corresponding to the debt of sin incurred either by himself or his forefathers. There are two methods by which evil spirit men may set up a condition of indemnity for sinful earthly men. First, there is the method in which the earthly man sets up the condition of indemnity to liquidate his sin, in which evil spirit men work directly on the earthly man, whom they obsess. The second method of setting up a condition of indemnity for the sin of an earthly man is to have an evil spirit descend to an evil earthly man. The evil spirit then influences the evil earthly man to perform substantially the evil works of his intention against the man setting up the indemnity condition. In both cases, if the man gladly endures the work of the evil spirit man as due, he can set up a condition of indemnity for his own sin and that of his ancestors. Thus he is allowed to enter the sphere of benefit of the new age. Thus, the works of the evil spirit man result in having exercised judgment on the earthly man for his sins, on behalf of God. Through their works, evil spirit men also are allowed to enter the sphere of benefit of the new age, with the same benefits as earthly men. 4. The theory of reincarnation viewed from the standpoint of resurrection through second coming for the providence of restoration, God has called many individuals and given each an appropriate share of the total mission, in order to accomplish the whole purpose. Meanwhile, each man has transferred his mission to many similar individuals in succession, until the mission is finally accomplished, having passed through many individuals throughout human history. The providence of restoration, beginning on the individual level, is headed for the final goal of the restoration of the entire cosmos, after passing through the family level, national level and worldwide level. Therefore, the mission of a certain person, though it may be a part of the whole, would begin first as an individual mission, and then broaden in scope to a family mission, national mission, and finally to a worldwide mission. Examples of this in the Bible include Abraham, with both an individual and family mission; Moses, with a national mission; and Jesus, with a worldwide mission. Also, the spirit men who left the missions unaccomplished on earth descend to earthly men whose missions are similar to those with which the spirit men were charged while on earth, and cooperate with them for the accomplishment of the will. Sin from the standpoint of mission, the physical body of the earthly man serves as the body of the spirit man. The earthly man, receiving the cooperation of the spirit man, would accomplish the mission of the spirit man as well as his own. In this case, the earthly man is the second coming of the spirit man who cooperates with him, so he often takes on the name of the spirit man. Therefore, the earthly man frequently appears to be the reincarnation of the spirit man. To take an example from the Bible, John the Baptist, in the course of fulfilling his mission through the cooperation of Elijah, had to accomplish the mission which Elijah had left unaccomplished while on earth. Jesus called John the Baptist Elijah, cf. Zechariah 3.2, 182, because John's body was the substitute for Elijah's body. In the last days, the earthly men in charge of specific worldwide missions are in a position to succeed the spirit men who formerly had these missions on earth, and to accomplish these missions. Accordingly, these spirit men descend to earthly men of their choice and, by cooperating with them, accomplish the missions which they left unfulfilled in their earthly lives. Therefore, the earthly man, receiving the cooperation of the spirit man, is the second coming of that spirit man. He also appears to be the reincarnation of the spirit man. This is why many people in the last days claim to be either Christ, Buddha, Confucius, or the olive tree or the tree of life. The doctrine of reincarnation, upheld by Buddhism, comes from an interpretation of external appearances, without knowing the theory of resurrection through second coming. Section 3, Unification of Religions by Resurrection through Second Coming 1. Unification of Christianity by resurrection through second coming, as stated in section 2, 3.2 of this chapter, the spirit men of the life spirit stage, paradise, descend to the earthly saints who are capable of attaining the divine spirit stage by believing in the Lord of the Second Advent and ministering to Him. They can finally enter the kingdom of heaven with the same merit as earthly saints by cooperating with them in accomplishing the will of the providence of restoration. Accordingly, in the days of the Second Advent, all the spirit men in paradise will descend to the earthly saints and cooperate with them. The time of this visitation may differ according to the individual's faith, his natural disposition, and his ancestors' accomplishments for the will of God. In this manner, earthly saints are sooner or later destined to attend the Lord of the Second Advent and devote themselves to the will of God, through the cooperation of the spirit men descending to them from paradise. Therefore, Christianity is destined to realize its unification. 2. Unification of all other religions by resurrection through second coming, as discussed in the consummation of human history. We cannot deny the historical fact that all religions, which in fact have an identical purpose, are being absorbed gradually into the cultural sphere of Christianity. Therefore, Christianity is not a religion for Christians alone, but has the mission of accomplishing the ultimate purpose of all the religions that have appeared in the past. Naturally, the Lord of the Second Advent, who comes as the central figure in Christianity, will also play the role of Buddha, whom Buddhists believe will come again, as well as the role of the true man whose appearance Confucianists anticipate, and Chungdu Ryang, herald of the righteous way, whom many Koreans expect to come. In addition, he will also play the role of the central figure whom all other religions await. For this reason, the spirit men who believed in religions other than Christianity while on earth will have to come again, like the spirit men of paradise, in order to receive the same benefit of resurrection through the second advent, though the time of their visitation may differ according to their spiritual positions. In this manner, they are destined to descend to the earthly men who belong to their religions and lead them to the Lord of the Second Advent, cooperating with them to believe in and serve Him for the accomplishment of the will of God. Therefore, all religions will finally be unified, centering on Christianity. 3. Unification of non religious men by resurrection through second coming. The spirit men who in their lifetime did not believe in any religion but lived conscientiously, also come again at permitted times in order to obtain the benefit of resurrection through second coming. In this way, they cooperate with earthly men of conscience to find and serve the Lord of the Second Advent and participate in accomplishing the will of God. The story of the three wise men coming from the east and worshipping the infant Jesus, Matthew 1-16, is one such example. The ultimate purpose of God's providence of restoration is to save all mankind. Therefore, it is God's intention to abolish hell completely, after the lapse of the period necessary for the full payment of all indemnity. If hell remains eternally in the world of creation even after the fulfillment of God's purpose of goodness, it would result in the contradiction of an imperfect God, not to speak of the resultant imperfection in His idea of creation and His providence of restoration. If the hearts of parents in fallen families are saddened by the unhappiness of even one of their children, how much more would it be so with God, as the heavenly parent? In 2 Peter 3-9 we find, "The Lord is forbearing toward you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance." Accordingly, hell cannot remain forever in the ideal world, which is to be realized in accordance with the will of God. Even the forces of Satan testified to Jesus being the Son of God, Matt 8-29. When the last days come, even evil spirits will descend to earthly men of the same level, and by cooperating with them will take part in the fulfillment of God's will. Finally, after a due period of time, the unified purpose of creation will be attained. There have been several occurrences of the last days in which the two sovereignties of good and evil came to the point of intersection. Both the time of Noah and that of Jesus were called the last days, with the two sovereignties at the point of intersection. But each time men failed to accomplish their portion of responsibility and were unable to destroy the sovereignty of evil. And God again had to start His providence for the separation of the good from the evil sovereignty. Consequently, we will see another intersection of the two sovereignties at the time of the second advent of the Lord. The course of the providence of restoration has thus repeated periodically the spiral movement of affairs going through the circular course toward the purpose of creation. This is why there have been many periods of similar nature in human history, cf. Part 2, ch. 3, sec. I. 373. 3. The phenomenon of the restoration of the third blessing. God's third blessing to men signifies Adam and Eve's dominion over the world of creation after they attained perfection. Man's dominion over the world of creation has two aspects, internal and external. We can see that in the present age the two aspects of man's dominion, lost with the human fall, are being restored. Internal dominion means the dominion of heart and zeal. When a man has perfected his individuality, he becomes one in heart and zeal with God. Thus he is able to experience God's own heart and zeal. On the day when man, after having perfected himself, comes to love the world of creation with heart and zeal identical to God's, and when he receives the beauty returned by the creation, he becomes the dominator in heart and zeal over the world of creation. However, due to the fall, man failed to experience God's heart and zeal and has not been able to regard the creation with God's heart and zeal. Nonetheless, God has been working His providence of restoration by means of religion, philosophy and ethics, constantly elevating by degrees the spiritual standard of fallen men toward God. Thus, man in the present age is restoring his qualification as the dominator in heart and zeal over the world of creation. External dominion means domination through science. If man, having perfected himself, had been able to dominate the world of creation internally with heart and zeal identical to that which God had over the world of creation at the time of its creation, man's scientific achievement could have reached its culmination in an extremely short time, because man's spiritual sensibility would have been developed to the highest dimension. Thus, men could have dominated externally all the things of creation. In consequence, man not only could have subdued the world of nature, including the heavenly bodies, at the earliest possible date, but he also could have brought about an extremely comfortable living environment due to the economic development that would have accompanied scientific achievement. However, man, by losing his spiritual light due to the fall and by thus being deprived of his internal domination over the things of creation, fell to the status of a barbarian with a spiritual sensibility as dull as that of the animals. Thus, he lost the external domination over creation. Man, according to God's providence of restoration, now has restored his spiritual light. Consequently, both his internal and external dominations have, by degrees, been restored. Therefore, scientific development in the present day has also reached its highest degree. So it has come about that modern men have created an extremely comfortable living environment, due to economic developments which followed brilliant scientific achievements. We see then that God's third blessing to men is being restored, and from this we cannot deny that today we have reached the last days. As we have observed repeatedly, the development of the cultural spheres also shows that a worldwide cultural sphere is now being formed centered on one religion. Nations, too, are moving toward one worldwide structure of sovereignty, starting from the League of Nations, through the United Nations and reaching today for world government. Regarding economic development, the world is now on the threshold of forming one common market. Extremely well-developed transportation and communication facilities have reduced the limitations of time and space. Men are able to communicate with one another on the earth as easily as if the earth were the garden of the house in which people of all the different races of the East and the West lived as one family. All mankind is crying out for brotherly love. However, a home is formed around the parents. There alone can true brotherly love occur. Therefore, upon the second advent of the Lord as the true parent of mankind, all men will come to live harmoniously in the garden as one family. From this too we may know that today is surely the last days. There must be one final gift which history, having thus progressed, is about to present to mankind. Thus must be the ideology of the macrocosmic nature that can bind all the strangers who now live in turmoil within one world without any true purpose, into one family centered on the same parents. Section 5, The Last Days, The New Truth, and Our Attitude 1. The last days and the new truth. Fallen men overcome their internal ignorance by raising their spiritual and intellectual standard through spirit and truth. John 4:23, according to their religion. Regarding truth, there are two kinds: internal truth religion, which will overcome internal ignorance, and external truth science, which will overcome external ignorance. Accordingly, man has two kinds of intellect: internal intellect, which is awakened by internal truth, and external intellect, which is awakened by external truth. Therefore, internal intellect in its pursuit of internal truth has set up religion, while external intellect in its pursuit of external truth has set up science. Spiritual matters pertaining to the invisible world first come into spiritual cognition through our spirit men by means of the five spiritual senses. Then they are physiologically recognized through the resonance of the five physical senses. The truth from the visible world, however, comes directly into our cognition by means of the five physical senses. Thus, the process of cognition takes place through both the spiritual and physical courses. Since man was made so that he could be perfect only when his spirit man and physical man are united, spirit and truth must be in perfect harmony, awakening man's spiritual and intellectual standard, before the two-sided cognition through both the spiritual and physical courses can completely coincide. Then, for the first time, man will come to have perfect cognition of the world of creation. In this manner, God is conducting His providence of restoring men to the original nature intended at the creation by raising through both spirit and truth, the spiritual and intellectual standard of men, who fell into utter ignorance due to the fall. Man, sharing the benefit of the age in God's providence of restoration, is gradually being elevated in his spiritual and intellectual standard as history progresses. Therefore, both spirit and truth, which are the means for raising the spiritual and intellectual standard, must also be elevated to higher levels by degrees. Although spirit and truth must be unique, eternal and unchanging, the extent, degree and method of teaching and expressing them to men, who are in the process of restoration from the status of ignorance, should vary according to the age. For example, in the age before the Old Testament from Adam to Moses, God did not provide the people with words of truth, but merely commanded them to offer sacrifices. Men in that age, being ignorant, could not receive the truth directly from Him. When the spiritual and intellectual standard of the people was elevated, He gave the law to the people of Moses' day, and the gospel to those of Jesus' day. Jesus did not say that His word was the truth, but that He Himself was the way, the truth and the life. John 14:6. This is because His words were only a means of expressing Himself as the truth. And the extent, degree and method of expressing the truth should vary according to those who receive the words. From this, we must realize that biblical words are a means of expressing the truth and are not the truth itself. Seeing matters from this point of view, we can understand that the New Testament was given as a textbook for the teaching of truth to the people of 2,000 years ago, people whose spiritual and intellectual standard was very low compared to that of today. It is thus impossible to satisfy completely man's desire for truth, in this modern scientific civilization, by using the same method of expressing the truth, in parables and symbols, which was used to awaken the people of an earlier age. In consequence, today the truth must appear with a higher standard and with a scientific method of expression in order to enable intelligent modern man to understand it. We call this the new truth. This new truth, as discussed in the general introduction, should be able to resolve completely the problems of religion and science according to one unified theme and thus overcome man's internal and external ignorance. Let us investigate other reasons that the new truth must appear. As noted, The Bible is not the truth itself but a textbook teaching us the truth. In this textbook, most of the important parts of the truth are revealed in parables and symbols. Consequently, the method of interpretation can differ according to the reader. Differences in interpretation have produced many denominations. Since the source of denominational divisions is not in man but in the expressions used in the Bible, the divisions and quarrels cannot but increase. Therefore, we cannot expect the divisions and quarrels between denominations to come to an end. This will hinder the fulfillment of the providence of restoration under the unification of Christianity, unless there appears a new truth that can elucidate the fundamental contents of the Bible so clearly that everyone can recognize and agree with it. Therefore, Jesus promised to give us new words of truth in the last days, saying, "I have said this to you in figures. The hour is coming when I shall no longer speak to you in figures but tell you plainly of the Father." John 16-25. Jesus died on the cross without being able to say all that he wanted to say because of the disbelief of the people. As he said, "If I have told you earthly things and you do not believe, how can you believe if I tell you heavenly things?" John 3-12. Jesus also said to his disciples, "I have yet many things to say to you but you cannot bear them now." John 16-12. This disclosed how sorrowful he was, because he could not tell even his own disciples what he had deep in his heart. The words Jesus left unuttered will not forever remain a secret, but are to be revealed someday as a new truth through the Holy Spirit. As Jesus told us, "When the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all the truth. For he will not speak on his own authority, but whatever he hears he will speak, and he will declare to you the things that are to come." John 16-13, again we read, "I saw in the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with seven seals." Rev 5-1, on this very scroll were the words the Lord is to give us in the last days. When John wept because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it, since there was no such person in heaven, on earth, or under the earth, one of the elders said, "The Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered, so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." Rev 5:3-5, the Lion born of the Root of David signifies Christ. Thus, the day must come when Christ will open the sealed scroll, which has long remained a secret to mankind, and reveal the new truth to all the saints. Therefore, it is said, "You must again prophesy about many peoples and nations and tongues and kings." Rev 10:11. Again, it is said, "And in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my Spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Yea, and on my men servants and my maid servants in those days I will pour out my Spirit. And they shall prophesy." Acts 2:17-18, thus, from many standpoints the new truth must come in the last days too. The attitude we should take in the last days if we observe the progression of the history of the providence of restoration, we see that the new always begins when the old is about to expire. Consequently, the period when the old ends is the very period when the new begins. The close of the old history is the starting period for the new history. Mankind is now at the point of intersection where the two sovereignties of good and evil are confronting each other. These two sovereignties, which started at the same point, have headed in opposite directions ever since, and have borne their own worldwide fruits respectively. People of this age fall into internal insecurity, terror and chaos due to the shallowness of their ideals and ideologies. Externally, they are afraid, as they face the threat of conflicts and struggles with terrifying weapons. In the last days many devastating phenomena will occur. As the Bible says, "For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places." Matt 24:7, it is inevitable that such misery should take place, in order that the dominion of evil be annihilated, and that of good be exalted. God, without fail, will set up the center of the sovereignty of goodness in order to establish a new age out of this misery. Noah, Abraham, Moses and Jesus were the central figures of their respective new ages. Therefore, we must find the central figure of the new history, whom God has designated, in order that we might be participants in the new age as God wants us to be. The providence of the new age does not start after the complete liquidation of the old age, but is born and grows in the circumstances of the period of consummation of the old age, always appearing to be in conflict with that age. Accordingly, this providence is not easily understood by those who are accustomed to the conventions of the old age. This is why the sages of history who came in charge of the providence of a new age all became victims of the old age. We can give the example of Jesus, who, coming at the close of the Old Testament age as the center of the new providence of the New Testament age, appeared to the believers of the Mosaic Law to be a heretic whom they could not understand. Finally, he was rejected because of their disbelief of him and was crucified. This is why Jesus said, "New wine must be put into fresh wineskins." Luke 5:38. Christ will come again at the close of the New Testament age as the center of the new providence to establish the new heaven and earth, and will give us new words for the building of the new age. Rev 21:1-7. Therefore, he is apt to be rejected and persecuted by Christians at the time of the Second Advent, just as Jesus was persecuted and derided at his coming by the Jews who said he was possessed by Beelzebub, the prince of demons. Matt 12:24. Therefore, Jesus predicted that first the Lord must suffer many things and be rejected by the generation at the time of the Second Advent. Luke 17:25. Therefore, those who, in the transitional period of history, are tenaciously attached to the environment of the old age and comfortable entrenched in it will be judged along with the old age. Fallen men, being very dull in their sensitivity towards spiritual things, will generally emphasize the old truth in following the course of the providence of restoration. In other words, these people will not respond to and follow the providence of the new age, even though the providence of restoration is bringing about the new age, because in most cases they are still attached to the view of truth of the old age. Those who can perceive spiritual things, however, will understand the providence of the new age spiritually, and come to respond to it, even though they may face discrepancies between the new view of truth and that of the old age. The disciples of Jesus, therefore, were not overly attached to the Old Testament. Rather, they followed what they felt spiritually in their hearts. The reason men of prayer and conscience feel a sense of extreme spiritual anxiety and urgency in the last days is that, while they vaguely feel spiritual things and are willing to follow the providence of the new age in their hearts, they have not met the new truth that can lead their external selves in the right direction. Therefore, if these men would only listen to the new truth leading them to the providence of the new age, they would be awakened in heart and intellect by spirit and truth simultaneously. They would be able to recognize perfectly the demand of God's providence for the new age. Naturally, then they will come to respond to it with untold happiness. Thus, modern men of the last days must try to perceive spiritual things through humble prayer. Thus, we should not be attached to conventional ideas but should at all costs find the new truth leading them to the providence of the new age. We can do this by directing our external self toward a spiritual purpose. Then we must ascertain whether the truth thus found becomes one with our spirit, producing a true heavenly joy deep within our heart. By doing this, the saints of the last days can find the way to true salvation. Chart, the world of creation and the providence of restoration through the substantial development of the Word.